For Antiwar.com, I'm Scott Horton. This is Antiwar Radio. And our next guest on the show is Kelly B. Vlahos. She's a Washington, D.C.-based freelance writer and political reporter for Fox News, a contributing editor at the American Conservative Magazine, Washington correspondent for Homeland Security Today magazine, and, of course, writes for us at antiwar.com quite often, and great stuff. Original.antiwar.com/Vlahos. That's V-L-A-H-O-S. Welcome back to the show. Kelly, how are you doing?
Good. Thanks for having me, Scott. I appreciate it.
Well, I'm really happy to have you here. Hey, where does the Taliban get all their money from?
Well, you know, that's a good question, and I had written a little story on this for American Conservative last month, and it would seem that the conventional wisdom is that the Taliban is getting most of their money from drug sales, from the opium / heroin industry in Afghanistan, but as stories like mine has emerged, I've indicated that they are getting a lot of their money from a very elaborate protection racket throughout the country, and meaning that the Taliban has been shaking down whether its own residents, its own Afghan people, but also private contractors who are working for the American government, for NATO countries, and for the U.S. military. So the checkpoints all across the country have stopped private contractors who are basically staffing convoys that are bringing shipments of material, food, supplies to reconstruction projects throughout the country, whether they be private or USAID. And what I wrote about would there are many, many instances where we have found that they're shaking down contractors bringing supplies to our troops on these forward operating bases. So, in essence, that the Taliban is getting its money from the U.S. taxpayer, if you want to really boil it down to that.
Well, so that seems like probably a good strategy to keep going forward with, right?
I know. Well, I mean, I had, you know, and I'm not the first, obviously not the first one to talk about this, but I found, there had been some stories out there, and I think that you had done some interviewing on this as well.
Yeah, I talked with Jean McKenzie, who
right.
I saw you cited from the Global Post.
Exactly. There. She had a great report where she had talked to Afghans who had been shaken down for some time and really came up with some figures in terms of how much they have to build into their invoices, so to speak, to do their jobs, whether it be a USAID contract or whatever. And I had done some interviewing myself and found this interesting nugget that, you know, it's not just private contractors working for humanitarian aid programs or reconstruction projects, but also these convoys that are snaking their way through these really difficult passes, these communication lines down from, you know, Uzbekistan, and then through Pakistan as well, that are being, you know, stopped at a given point and being forced to pay security money so they can get through. And a lot of them do get through, and our troops get their supplies, and the NATO troops get their supplies, and other ones, you know, are blown up. But there's enough getting through so that these guys are making a nice tidy sum that they can go and buy weapons and, you know, you know, fund their fighters. So it's a really creepy situation. And
yeah, well, it sounds like a really great way to run stuff, too. I mean, I guess if we sort of start with the premise that that's the whole point of this thing anyway, is just perpetual war for perpetual war's sake. It's good for the guys in the Pentagon and for the military industries that they procure their equipment from, for the Dianne Feinstein's husband's company,
right,
or Dick Cheney's old company that get to follow the military around building all the bases and whatever. If the whole point of this thing is just to take all our money away or whatever, then this is just sort of the cherry on top or the icing on the cake or whatever, right?
Right. It's perpetual war, literally a cyclical, you know, thing. And and everything you just said is completely accurate and you know, it really does jibe with the whole scheme that, you know, of the perpetual war feeding this war machine. But at some point, the American public, and maybe this is why we don't hear about this too often, the American public's going to wake up and say, oh, my God, you know, we can't give this little old lady down the street health care, but I'm supposed to believe that my money is going to a good, my tax money is going to a good cause. You're telling me that it's finding its way into Taliban pockets, and they're just basically bleeding us dry over there. You know, and maybe I'm giving the American public too much credit, but I was very surprised, Scott, that there wasn't more people interested. There weren't more people interested in talking about this subject when I had, you know, made some phone calls to the Foreign Relations Committee, the Armed Services Committee. I made a few calls to congressmen's offices who had recently been to Afghanistan, thinking that this is something they might want to talk about. You know, and I'm talking about, you know, Democrat and Republican lawmakers who, you know, might want to raise, you know, a red flag about where our money is going. And nobody wanted to talk about this. You know, I can understand the military not wanting to talk about this. Yeah, we're getting shaken down by the Taliban. But there seems to be a real hesitancy for the American people to really hear the true story about where their tax money is going. I mean, it's easy to talk about the drug money because that's something we can all understand, and it's supposedly going on over there. But to think that our money is going directly into Taliban pockets just to get our food and supply and materiel out to our troops, you know, and that could get cut off at any time. You know, that's a sensitive subject, but I think it could bring the whole thing down if enough people are outraged about it. I mean, again, maybe I'm giving the situation a little more too much credit, but I think it's an explosive story.
Yeah, well, obviously, but it's one of those stories that's too big to break. You can see why Congress people would be, oh, well, you know, this would get me in the headlines, but it doesn't really seem like something I actually want to pursue in real life, so I think maybe I'll just kind of, we'll just leave that one alone.
Right, and then you saw this story about how the Italians supposedly had been paying the Taliban, you know, protection money for years, and they lost like one guy in 1 year in this particular this area of operations, and they didn't tell the French, who were, you know, basically taking over for them in August, and the French didn't know anything about payments or shakedowns or anything, and then they
yeah,
get
you didn't
ambushed.
Tell us who we had to bribe.
Yeah, and they get ambushed. I mean, you know, it was a terrible situation. Their bodies were mutilated, and you know, and so it just came out this week that, you know, that the Italians had been paying off the Taliban all this time. Now, they deny it, but there was numerous sources that, you know, had confirmed that this had been going on. But you wonder how widespread is this practice of paying off local warlords, local fighters for protection money, and you're thinking, why the hell are we over there?
Well, you know, this is the thing, too. I was watching a deal on CNN this morning. Where the guy's interviewing college kids about what they think about Afghanistan. And basically it was just a contest for who can sound most like the people on TV by regurgitating their talking points. And I guess one of the girls there, they said she was Special Forces, which, you know, I don't know. She didn't look like a Delta guy to me. But anyway, and basically they all just, you know, did the Mina Bird impression and said something to the effect that, whoa, you know, we are responsible and we have to nation build. And yes, well, you know, most successful counterinsurgencies take 30 years. That was what the Special Forces girl said with a shrug, you know,
right.
And then all the rest of these kids are basically, no one was brave enough to put up their hand when, he asked if anyone was against the war or even against the escalation, I think. And really out of the whole group, the college students and the CNN guy, it was the CNN guy, from the controlled corporate Pentagon media who was saying, geez, are you guys kidding? kidding me? Was that really the deal after September 11th? Was generations upon generations of occupying and remaking this place? And here's what I'm really getting to by telling you this whole story, is that it reminds me of what my friend Lewis is always saying, oftentimes about conservatives in a different context, but it's the same kind of thing. Paraphrasing Carl Sagan, talking about people grasping in the dark. They have no grounding in real knowledge, and so basically anything that comes shooting at them is basically, you know, up for grabs, might as well be true until they hear something different next or whatever, but they don't have any real context. They don't understand, you know, what it is that they're actually even talking about at all. They say things like, you know, they invoke the Pottery Barn rule or whatever.
Right, right.
But none of this says, well, listen, we're paying our enemy that we're fighting, that we can't cross into our neighboring allied state, Pakistan, to finish them off, and in order to do so would take our entire Marine Corps and tens of thousands of casualties probably to try to invade and occupy the Hindu Kush Mountains, and all we're doing is creating more enemies, and these people didn't even do us wrong anyway. They were on our payroll. It was the Al-Qaeda who did it, and they're all dead other than bin Laden and Zawahiri, who we can't get to. And so, you know, all these things that I'm sure you have a great many other things to say about what to take into account about counterinsurgency strategy and what the land in Afghanistan is like and the different factions there and all these things, but none of the conversation there about whether we need to escalate or not, whether we need to commit to 30 years worth of sending kids to go kill and die over there, had anything to do really with the reality of the war. It was all just a sloganeering thing. These people are lost in the dark. So I was wondering if maybe you could sort of illuminate their path a little bit and help explain what is an Afghanistan anyway? What is this place? How are we going to conquer it? How is the counterinsurgency doctrine going to fix all of our terrible problems there, Kelly?
Well, I just for a second, I'd just like to address the kids that you had were kids, or the students that you had, you know, had mentioned. You know, it seems to me that there's two things going on here. One is that you have, you know, less than 0.5% of the American population is in the armed forces. So you have a real tiny, all-volunteer force that's doing all the fighting. And so the rest of the population is sort of almost vaguely aware of what is going on. And if they don't inform themselves, they don't keep an open mind, they, like you said, they're allowing themselves to be sort of spoon-fed information from these really biased, agenda-driven sources. Second of all, I remember when I was in college in the early 90s, during the whole Balkans fiasco, there was a lot of kids, a lot of students who sort of had been weaned on the stories of Vietnam and the peace protests and the anti-war movement, who were pretty much itching to get involved, and in terms of either informing themselves about what was going on, what the Clinton administration was doing, and fight it, you know. But there was this funny thing that the Clinton administration had invoked this sort of humanitarian mission, and that sort of that veneer had been placed over the whole thing. So there were, I saw a lot of people who were sort of like struggling to understand what exactly was going on over there, but were being force-fed this notion that we were going over there to save these people at the butt of a gun. And I see that happening now. The Obama administration comes in and makes, you know, declares this sort of grandiose Afghanistan strategy back in March, which is sort of a hodgepodge of counterterrorism and counterinsurgency, these vague notions of replacing corrupt governments and institutions with clean and forward-thinking ones and helping those people and liberating women. And it's really hard for people who don't have a strong point of view or aren't informing themselves to stand up and say, wait a minute, are we making things worse by going in there and trying to impose our values on other people at the butt of a gun? And it's this whole humanitarian edge, this sort of, you know, whatever you want to call these Democrats who believe that we can go and spread democracy and, you know, it's all about using the military force for good, who have sort of created this illusion and have sort of crafted the debate their way. So you have these college students or you have people who aren't involved in the military going, well, you know, I think we're doing it for a good reason, and if we leave, we're going to be leaving a hellhole behind, and Taliban's going to come over, and it's going to put women in burqas, you know, and I see this from people, you know, twice, three times their age say the same thing. Well, what if we leave? What's going to happen? You know, so you're right. There's this real one-sided myopic debate going on. And unless we inform ourselves, it's really depressing. It's really depressing.
Well, so,
I know that didn't answer your question.
No, that's okay, because
it
was a really long question. So I'm glad I gave you an opportunity to say that. But now tell them about Afghanistan, because
okay.
This whole, I've read your articles, and I know that you know very well, and you explain very well how, well, at least maybe if I can help get you started here.
Yeah.
To do a counterinsurgency implies that you are an empire occupying someone else's country and you're trying to figure out a way to get them to finally just give up and lay prone and accept your domination of their society. That's
right.
What it means, right? So
yeah.
That's all it's a euphemism for in the first place.
Right. It really is. It is basically, you know, you're going in and convincing the indigenous population of a place that they have to support a, quote, centralized, you know, legitimate government, that you are in there to help. So if we would take Afghanistan, supposedly the counterinsurgency that we are engaging in would involve a centralized government, you know, i.e. the Karzai government. We go out and prop up that government by convincing, you know, the population of Afghanistan that they need to support this government and sort of eschew all of these other insurgent elements. And to do this, they would have to go in and they would both have to sort of, quote, win hearts and minds of the people while fighting the insurgents and taking them down, reducing their numbers, yada, yada, yada. I am not a counterinsurgency expert, and there's lots of theorists out there that would probably have better explanations, but I mean, if you really wanted to do counterinsurgency right, you would basically have to really sort of, you know, raise some of these villages. I mean, just obliterate them of insurgents. You'd have to go door to door, and I mean, you'd basically have to put in tens of thousands more troops than they're even talking about now. I think somebody threw around a figure of like 250,000. Counterinsurgents, whether that's a hodgepodge of Afghan, NATO, and U.S. forces, but at least 250,000, so I think that's the ballpark, to actually fan out into the country that large and start getting into villages and doing your thing. Now, I don't think the American people, you know, for all of their patience and of all of their sort of like vague notions of what this is all about is going to support something that big.
Well, and of course the whole thing is counterintuitive too, and it's again one of these circular things where we all know, right, that if we had a million troops there to do their thing and help people, the people of that country are not going to accept our occupation forever just because there's lots of us. I mean, they might realize I guess if we put millions of soldiers and they had absolutely no way to fight back without getting shot in 5 minutes or something, then
right.
We might be able to keep them from fighting back for some limited amount of time or something. But this can't go on permanently. It only creates, as everybody says, even Petraeus said, right, that the more troops we put in there, the more resistance there is. The more guys we have shooting at them, the more people join them to shoot back at our guys.
Right.
So the whole thing just continues to justify itself. They say that we're clearing and holding and building and doing all these things, but really what they're doing is creating more enemies for them to continue to clear, hold, and build against.
Right. Exactly, and they constantly compare this to Iraq, and I know you and I have talked about this before, you know, and there seems to be this resignation on the part of the media, you know, and members of Congress that Iraq was somehow a success, you know, a model to be held up.
Yeah, don't tell the million dead people about
right.
that. They can't hear you anyway, so it's convenient.
Right. But, you know, if you're going to take what these guys are saying is that, well, we went in there, you know, we enjoined, meaning we paid off the Sunnis to help us fight al-Qaeda and the sort of the ragtag insurgents to support the Maliki's government. We giving Maliki a chance to get a foothold and to, you know, to basically, you know, stabilize his government. And, you know, and the story goes on from there. And they think they're going to replicate this in Afghanistan. And they've been saying that from the beginning. Now, as you can see, they're not doing that. And they're having more and more difficulties explaining why they haven't gone into these villages and made all of these allies among the warlords and the tribal leaders and the villagers, and why they're still struggling against Taliban attacks and these at these outposts. Because there is not a viable comparison between the two countries. And second of all, Iraq was a, you know, it we can debate whether that was a successful counterinsurgency to begin with. So I think that
I would say that no, there's not a debate. The people who memorized the slogan, the surge worked, did a great job of slogan memorization. But the truth is, as Patrick Coburn, who's the authority on this, and who obviously what he says happens to coincide with all the other, you know, actual information out of that country, is that America helped one side win a civil war against the other side and almost entirely push the Shiite militias, almost entirely push the Sunni population out of Baghdad, and then finally accepted an offer that the leaders of the Sunni insurgency had made in 2003 and 2004 and 2005, and they finally accepted it in 2006, which was, listen, just pay us, let us police our own communities, and we'll fight the suicide bomber guys with you. And so they finally accepted that, counterinsurgency genius and General Petraeus and whatever. The simple facts of the case are simple facts. It's not all even that complicated to refute that line. It's just that nobody ever had a chance to do so on TV, and so it never got done, I guess.
Right, right.
You know, I'm reading Tom Hayden, and I think he's going to be on the show tomorrow. The next day, he wrote this thing, another great piece for The Nation about the Long War, as they call it.
That.
And he's quoting in there a guy named Kilcullen in his book, The Accidental Guerrilla, I believe it is.
Right.
And apparently, the core theoreticians of long war new coin theory here apparently completely accept the Hortonian, Greenwaldian, Scheuerian, Lawrence Wrightian, James Bamfordian thesis that they hate us because our empire occupies their countries and supports their dictatorships and kills them, and not because we are free and wonderful. And yet, and they really do accept that. They say, yeah, of course, that's why they're fighting us. But so that simply means that we have to be very careful in exactly how we occupy, to try to kill as many of them as resist us as possible without generating too many more new ones. And then the kind of unsaid thesis there is, and then we can occupy and dominate Central Asia forever.
Yeah.
I mean, that's basically what they're talking about. I mean, they accept Michael Scheuer's thesis that they hate us for what we've done and list the reasons and all that. It's right there in Hayden's article at The Nation.
Well, quite
remarkable to me. I would have thought that they would stick with the whole, no, they hate us because we're good and that's why we have to fight them over there and all that.
Exactly.
But they're really conceding the entire argument to me. Kelly, what if George Bush had said, what if Barack Obama said, listen, 3,000 of you civilians are going to have to die every once in a while in these kinds of terrorist attacks, but that's the price we pay for having an empire, so get used to it. We wouldn't have got used to it. We just said no. They had to lie to us to get us to go for all this.
It boggles the mind, and someone like David Kilcullen is very savvy because he had been part of David Petraeus's so-called brain trust during Iraq. He was right there at the beginning, middle, and end of the surge. He was in full support of COIN, the whole doctrine that Petraeus had developed, all the way through till the Obama administration took over. And I'm not saying that he's taken back anything that he supported, but with the accidental guerrilla and subsequent things that he's written and talked about, you can see that he, between the lines, is basically saying that the war is lost over there in Afghanistan, that the longer we stay, the longer that we carry out this mission of, you know, dropping, you know, predator drone strikes on Pakistan and over into Afghanistan and killing people, you know, that we are going to create more insurgents than we had ever planned for. So he kind of wants it both ways. He doesn't want to lose all his friends in the counterinsurgency crowd. So he still supports counterinsurgency. He was part of a big report put forth by the Center for New American Security on Afghanistan and Pakistan and the way forward and putting in more troops. You know, he's totally for putting more troops in and carrying out the counterinsurgency mission. But on the other hand, he's quoted pretty liberally talking about how we are basically cutting off our nose to spite our face when we go into these places and engage in, you know, violent behavior and the predator drone strikes. So I think that there's a lot of people out there like Kilcullen who basically talk out of both sides of their mouth about what we should be doing there, and it confuses the whole issue. And then we wake up and we realize and we're being told that we have, like, you know, two options. Either we put, you know, 50,000 more troops into Afghanistan and carry out this McChrystal-style counterinsurgency, or we start paying off Taliban like we did in Iraq to get out of there. I don't know. I don't think either of those options are very attractive, but it seems like that we don't really have a lot of options right now.
Well, there was at least a purported Taliban spokesman, I think, in the London Independent the other day, right, that said, hey, listen, we're willing to make a deal and turn over the Arabs you're looking for if you'll just leave us alone, right?
Yeah.
I mean, which was the deal they gave us in the first place that
right.
George Bush wouldn't accept.
Right.
Because we had to let people fly kites again and stuff.
Exactly. Now, I don't know where that leaves us, Scott. I don't know if we start paying off Taliban, we start parsing out, well, this is good Taliban and this is bad Taliban and these are our friends and these are our foes. I don't know where that leaves us, because does it leave us more vulnerable? You know, I've read, you know, people have talked about this and they said, well, you know, we can make all the deals we want with these guys, but who's going to say they're going to keep them? They don't have a great track record. On the other hand, we start paying them off. What does that say to the rest of the world? You know, we dumped, you know, all this money, all this resources, all these lives into Afghanistan for the past 8 years, and now we're going to just start paying them off so we can leave. You know, on the other hand, we don't want to put tens of thousands of more troops in there. At least I don't think that's the right way to do it. But it doesn't seem like we have a lot of options out there. And I think this goes all the way back to what the initial strategy during the Bush administration, why we're there in the first place. You know, I think it questions all of that, undergirds all of that.
Right. And, you know, I think, and maybe I'm wrong, but I think it's all about trying to control the Caspian Basin and all those oil flows and to, you know, check Russia. We won the Cold War, and so we get to kick them while they're down and all that kind of thing. Except, if I was Vladimir Putin, I would be laughing. And I think all the access that he's giving us to use former Soviet invasion routes into Afghanistan is proof that he's laughing at us and saying, oh, yeah, how about we'll give you your own Afghanistan, just like you gave us our own Vietnam in Afghanistan. We'll just replay the same thing again. Go to it. You need invasion routes? Come on in.
Well, I really can't. I'm still trying to wrap my brain around this announcement today that Karzai is going to accept a runoff situation. I don't know what the finer details of that are.
Oh yeah, I forgot to ask you about the completely bogus government that we're supposedly supporting there, which after all was won with threats that will burn your house down if you don't vote Karzai in the first place back in 2004.
Right. Right. So, I mean, we knew that this guy was crooked as a dog's hind leg to begin with. We knew this election was already bought by the time Obama got into office. We let it go, we played it down, you know, and then it turns out, okay, you know, we knew this was going to happen, you know, a million votes or whatever are fraudulent. And now we're going to turn around and say we'll have a runoff. I really can't wrap my brain around what deals were made. I haven't read anything yet, but it seems like some deal was hatched. I don't know what it might be, and whether or not Karzai will even go through with this, and will he win again? What happens when he wins again? I mean, or are we stuck with Abdullah Abdul, which I don't have a lot of confidence. He's much different than Karzai. So I'm trying to figure out where all the pieces are.
Yeah. Speaking of similarities with Iraq and all that, if they're going to stick with their propaganda that no, really, we're creating a democracy here, if they really try to do that, then of course the people who take power are going to be people who want us out of the country.
Right.
Now, that's why the election is not fair at all. They didn't let all the Pashtun tribesmen vote in the thing. All the Taliban and all those guys didn't get to have their say. I mean, the Sunnis deliberately boycotted the elections in Iraq at least the first time, but not the second and whatever. So that analogy, doesn't hold. But, the idea that America can invade and mass murder a bunch of people and then create a popular government there that's going to invite us to stay forever seems pretty contradictory on its face.
It does. And from what I'm reading, today, is that the military doesn't want to wait to see who's in office, who wins this election. I mean, they've got the full court press on the Obama administration to go ahead with an escalation of troops. And, you and I have both witnessed the sort of military PR campaign over the last several weeks to push Obama's hand on this. And I think Gates, Secretary of Defense Gates had been quoted as suggesting that, they can't wait for a runoff or to see who is the next president of Afghanistan. So you got that happening too. So I'm not sure. I go back and forth. On one hand, it looks like the Obama administration is going to cave to McChrystal and company. On the other hand, he seems to be staying pretty resolute on his, on his idea that he needs to, gauge and assess the situation more. On the other hand, there's a lot of people out there pushing. Are you man enough? Do you have the stomach enough to go through with this? And then, there are others in the media who are, pressuring the president not to put in more troops. So you have these conflicting forces, so I don't know which way it's going to go. But I do know that the military is resolved at pushing this thing. And it's extraordinary the sort of authority and swagger, that the military and their surrogates have. Why isn't he listening to his commanders on the ground? How dare he try to make an independent decision on this? I mean, it's appalling, really. But I just don't know which way it's going to go at this point. I don't really have a gut on it.
Well, it's been a long time coming in terms of the Pentagon becoming the predominant power in the country and in the empire overall. But I think maybe this is partially some of the signs of it. It was camouflaged in a way, or it had a different spin on it when it was under George Bush. We all saw this revolution going on within the form of the executive branch and all that kind of thing. But
right.
Now that it's a president that apparently these military guys don't respect so much, now we can see kind of in contrast how much authority they really at least
right.
think that they have gained.
Right. And it's like it is though their respect is very conditional, and fickle. Whereas with when you had George Bush in there, he's a Republican, he's a man's man. There was sort of like this just hand in glove situation. I was reading in the New York Times today had a piece about how the military has been getting restless because demoralized because Obama hasn't made a move on his strategy. Now, I think one could probably make the argument that if Obama came in March and said, I have a strategy for Afghanistan, there should have been some serious decisions already made, and for him not to be engaging in these further assessments that seem to go on forever. But on the other hand, for an entire, article to be written about how the military is losing its respect for its commander in chief because he's not moving fast enough for them. I find that very strange and interesting. And
it depends too on, and maybe I'm just suffering a bit of confirmation bias here, but I love it when Aaron Watata says, no, I will not go serve in an illegal war. I don't care what you say, I don't want to go to prison, but I'd rather go to prison than go lead men into committing war crimes and all that kind of thing. On the other hand, and I like it when Admiral Fallon and the Joint Chiefs of Staff tell George Bush, no, dude, we're not bombing Iran. Bad idea. Trust
right.
us on this one. On the other hand, when the president seems like he's reluctant to escalate, and they're saying, you know, threatening to resign over over not escalating, then all of a sudden I'm yelling insubordination and whatever. So I don't know, maybe there's really a qualitative difference there other than point of view, but I haven't quite nailed it down.
Right.
Trying to justify myself better for the future, you know?
Yeah, totally. I mean,
that's not really the same thing, is it? Trying to stop a war and trying to start one at
right, exactly. And in the massive politicization of this war by the military is extraordinary, and nobody even talks about it. At least they don't talk about it in the mainstream. Why a general is out there pushing his case for a policy change, you know, and all he gets is a mild sort of slap on the hand by Gates after he makes, you know, he's making McChrystal's making speeches, basically telling, you know, saying that, you know, any ideas that Joe Biden has for de-escalating this war are stupid. I mean, those weren't his exact words, but that's what the message was.
Yeah.
So to have him and Petraeus and all their surrogates who are everywhere in the media, you know, fighting for their cause, which is, you know, a direct conflict with what the White House is doing, is just, it's unbelievable to me.
Well, you know, who's keeping his fingerprints off of this as much as possible anyway is Robert Gates, the Secretary of Defense.
Yeah.
Now, he's the civilian commander of the military between the president and these generals. Is this not a threat to his own ambition? Is he not supposed, isn't this making him look like he's losing control of his people, not just the president? And isn't it then, shouldn't he have the incentive to tell them to, hey, you shut up and do your complaining through me? I guess he did that a little bit, but
yeah,
only a little.
He did that a little bit, you know, and he seems to have, you know, and I mean, I don't really have as much skepticism or animus towards him as I had some other people.
Oh, you need to read some Robert Perry then.
Oh, I'm sure if I did my reading, I would. But he seems to emerge a little bit more unscathed, let's just say, than the others in the current debate, because he isn't putting himself out there. And, you know, I like what he did in terms of, you know, sending out that dictate that, you know, the coffins can be photographed. I know that is a small gift that he gave. But he does seem to have some pragmatic impulses that I'm sure I would be disabused of thinking if I did read Robert Perry. But I don't know. I really don't know what's up with him. I don't think I'm qualified to really talk too much about, you know, where his motivations lie. So it will be interesting in the coming weeks. One question I did have is, like, I still can't figure out what the whole Galbraith firing was about. And, you know, why that nobody sort of leaped to his defense from the administration? And was it because they knew that this Karzai fraudulent vote runoff thing was going to happen and he was sort of the fall guy? I mean, do you have any? I know you're supposed to be interviewing me, but I don't know where he fits into all of this. And, you know, the whole Brooke Clinton team seems so sneaky to me that I just.
Yeah.
I just don't.
On the surface, the Peter Galbraith thing was that he resigned. He was kind of the heroic whistleblower sort of guy who said, I just cannot countenance this fraud without telling the truth about it in the Washington Post. Right?
Right. Exactly.
Who, like, quit for good reasons.
It seemed as though he quit for good reasons. Now, Hillary Clinton, supposedly a friend of his, Richard Holbrooke, a good friend of his, they were completely mum on the issue that their friend had been sacked in such a way by the UN, sacked because he told the truth, you know, allegedly about these fraudulent votes. It said, you know, the UN is trying to cover this up. It's not about whether there's fraudulent votes. It's about whether if they should even address it. And nobody came to his defense. I mean, I just don't. It's hard to gauge, you know, what this administration, what their next move is. But it is interesting that 2 weeks later they're able to cut some deal with Karzai over these fraudulent votes that we, you know, that this guy was fired over 2 weeks ago. I don't know.
Well, you know, John Bolton's spin on it aside and all that kind of thing, it does seem strange, doesn't it, that the president keeps, there's all these little leaks here and there about this many thousands of troops are going to go or not or whatever, and then you have British papers and this and that, and yet this procrastination, Just not necessarily whether it indicates good or bad, because I always just assume the worst anyway, but it is kind of strange in and of itself, isn't it, that they're basically going weeks and weeks debating this thing all in the media and the Joe Biden position and all, everybody's doing their selective leaking. What is with this guy Obama, man? Anyway, what is going on there?
Well, I think if you want to take the most cynical view of it, I think, you know, and this came to me today, you know, it seems as though he's just perpetually putting his finger up to the wind. I don't, you know, unless he's got a broader and grander scheme, you know, that he's holding back from us, I just think that he doesn't really know what to do. And he's putting his finger up to the wind, trying to gauge what public opinion is on this. It's probably the best thing for us because we don't want to see escalation there, that he hasn't made some rash decision and wasn't bullied outright by McChrystal and company to go charging into Afghanistan with 40,000 more troops. But it does make one wonder, you know, like you said, all these little trial balloons that seem to be going out. And it doesn't help that each side has all their surrogates and they're out there on talk radio and television and talking about, you know, making their case, and you really don't get a clear view from the White House what they actually want.
Yeah. And of course, you got Hillary Clinton, as you mentioned in there, and she could, you know, if I was Barack Obama, I wouldn't trust her at all, man. I wouldn't know what she was really doing, because she's certainly doing something other than just what he told her.
Yeah,
I mean, just because she's her. I mean, I don't know anything exactly how she's undermining him, but I'm sure she is.
Well, and I mean, and she, in her own history, her, you know, her whole pedigree is intervention for peace. So it wouldn't surprise me. I mean, she's not come out outright and said, I'm for pursuing this counterinsurgency in Afghanistan with more boots on the ground. But I wouldn't doubt that that's what she's lobbying for behind the scenes. Her and Richard Holbrooke, but she's been pretty savvy about, you know, not making any waves with the White House about that. But I wouldn't be surprised if she's lobbying pretty hard. Hmm. You know, he basically helped populate the State House with all of the State Department with all of these ex-Clinton types. I mean, they've all packed their bags, moved right back in. So it's not surprising when you have this sort of tug and pull going on about what to do next. I went back and I read his, you know, basically the reports and some of his texts from when he announced back in March about his Afghan strategy. And it was so vague that anybody could have taken from that many different things. But two key things were that he was for counterinsurgency and nation building, and he was also for a sort of more narrow focus on the Al-Qaeda types that will remain there. And those are two conflicting missions. So it's not surprising that we have all this conflict going on now about what he means, you know, what he meant then, what does he mean now, why isn't he acting what he said he was going to do, and is that what he really said he was going to do? Because it was like it was deliberately vague. It said nothing.
Well, maybe it'd be a brand new interview here, but it makes me think that they're all trying to work the escalation in Afghanistan in their calendar in with the war against Iran.
Oh.
You know, that's the part of the strategizing that we're leaving out here, really, is, you know, well, maybe we should nuke Iran first, or, you know, at least bomb the hell out of them with giant conventional weapons that might as well be nukes, and then escalate, because we don't want to just drop a bunch of guys within missile range of Iran and leave them defenseless right before we pick a fight with them.
Right. But the funny thing is, not that funny, is that Iran was helping us after 2001. You know, they were helping go after terrorists for us. They have interest in Afghanistan. They have as much interest in Afghanistan as we do. And if we had just reached out, we being, you know, the White House, had just reached out and started really talking to them about how we could all work together to make Afghanistan a more stable place so we can get out of there, I think we would make much more, there'd be much more traction there instead of this sort of constant, you know, chafing with them on one hand and the escalation of the troops on the other. I mean, it just seems that we're working against our own interests.
Well, and instead of working with the Iranians, they started to do up until the Axis of Evil speech and
right.
all that, after September 11th, instead they're bringing the Indians in. And Karzai, has this alliance with the Indians. And this, of course, only puts more pressure on the government of Pakistan
right.
to continue backing the Taliban to prevent the Karzai government from ever attaining any kind of monopoly on force, because then they'll be surrounded by their perceived enemies in India. And so, boy, that's why they called it strategery, because it doesn't
right.
make any sense really at all.
It isn't. And I, you know, I don't want to come on your show and act as though that I'm a geopolitical whiz or a counterterrorism expert. You know, I basically look at the media and the Washington culture and how it's sort of absorbing all of these messages and how they are manipulating, you know, in return messages that go out to the public. And, you know, what I'm getting is that there are a lot of cross interests here in Washington, and none of them seem to be in our best interest as taxpayers and as citizens. And it is very scary when you have the media, and I had written, you know, in a couple columns about their surrogates here in Washington, Kimberly Kagan being one of them. You know, I think it's up to us as citizens and taxpayers to look at these messages. Who's giving them? What does it mean? What's the agenda? Because I think that, you know, just you and I trying to hammer this out, it does sound very confusing. And I think because it is very confusing, nobody knows what our interests are and, how these competing missions and proposals will really shake out in terms of making us safer or getting us out of these you know, hotbeds any sooner. So, I don't know.
All right, everybody, that's Kelly Vallejos. She writes for FoxNews.com. She's a contributing editor at the American Conservative Magazine, Washington correspondent for Homeland Security Today, and, again, original.antiwar.com/Vallejos.